It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
Particularly young people need them. We oftentimes think of advance directives as something that only apply to elderly people or those that have a serious medical condition, but the best examples that I like to give are the fact that the major cases that made the law and made the news in the United States with respect to advance directives were all women in their 20s. And if men are out there wondering, well, how does this affect me, then the example I like to give is Lance Armstrong. He got his cancer in his 20s. So we just never know. It could be a car accident. It could be a stroke. It could be dementia. We just never know.
Private attorney Nathan Kottkamp at McGuire Woods discusses the upcoming National Healthcare Decisions Day on Saturday, April 16, and explains how easy and important it is to just do it and sign two vital advance directives, a medical power of attorney, and a living will. And during this week's question and answer session, we discuss the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and the limitations it places upon debt collectors talking to you about other people's debts. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 122, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. As expected, the car title lenders can't help themselves and cannot follow the new Virginia law that went into effect October 1, 2010. The Virginia Poverty Law Center, or VPLC, reports multiple debt collection abuse by car title lenders. One consumer who was behind on his car title loan received a call threatening to report his car as stolen and then, quote, "Your wife will be arrested if she is pulled over while driving it," unquote. This threat was repeated to his sister-in-law and her husband. The new law requires car title lenders to comply with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and prohibits harassing, abusive, false, misleading, deceptive, or unfair practices in collections. Unlike some provisions of the new law, the section appears to apply to pre-October 1st loans because it merely says each licensee shall comply, with no limiting language about loans made on or after October 1st. Anyone being abused by car title lenders may call the VPLC Car Title Loan Hotline toll-free at 866-830-4501 and also may complain to the State Corporation Commission's Bureau of Financial Institutions at www.scc.virginia.gov/BFI and clicking on File a Complaint. In other news, Richmond has the region's highest rate of people who can't afford housing, with 35% paying more than 30% of their income for housing. Housing is considered unaffordable if it costs more than 30% of a family's income. An affordable housing trust fund is a funding mechanism used in more than 700 places around the country to support the creation of affordable housing. Richmond's Affordable Housing Trust Fund was created in a 2008 ordinance, but it never has been funded, and its oversight board has never been fully appointed and has never met. This may change. At the Nehemiah Action tomorrow, Richmonders Involved to Strengthen Our Communities, or RISC, will ask City Council members, most of whom will be in attendance, to commit to four specific actions: fully appointing the board, developing policies to administer the funds, targeting the fund to the neediest, and dedicating a source of revenue for the fund. These commitments to action will be requested at tomorrow's Nehemiah Action, which starts at 6:15 p.m. at Good Shepherd Baptist Church, 1127 North 28th Street on Church Hill in Richmond. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Ellis versus Ritchie. Dorothy Ellis, a 47-year-old single mother with one dependent child, had been on the Section 8 housing voucher program for 8 years. In March 1991, she recertified her eligibility, saying she had no bank accounts. A few weeks later, Section 8 learned about an account Ms. Ellis had at IBM Credit Union. Ms. Ellis had opened the account for an illiterate friend who had asked her to manage his money because his family had been taking advantage of him. She had not disclosed the account because the money did not belong to her. But Section 8 ended her assistance. After a hearing affirming the termination, Ms. Ellis sued in federal court, which reversed. The court found that Ms. Ellis had complied with all requests to submit information and had no intent to deceive. Further finding that she should have disclosed the credit union account, the court held that because she was not told of the requirement to disclose an account held for another, she could not be penalized for failing to do so. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Ellis versus Ritchie is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time once again for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Would you tell us your name and where you're from?
Fred from Henrico.
Welcome to the show, Fred. What question do we have this week?
What can I do about creditor harassment when it has nothing to do with me and they continuously to call me and harass me when it has to do with someone else, another family member?
Now, are you being called by the creditor themselves asking about somebody else's debt, or are you being called by a debt collection agency or debt collector asking about somebody else's debt?
Both.
The reason I ask that question is because your legal rights depend greatly on whether you're being contacted by the creditor themselves or by the debt collector or debt collection agency collecting somebody else's debt. In the first case, you have no real legal rights because the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act does not apply to creditors collecting their own debts. So other than, I guess, reporting to the phone company that a creditor is making nuisance calls and calling you about something that has nothing to do with you, there's really no legal rights involved. The story is quite different, though, if you are being contacted by a debt collector or debt collection agency to try to collect debts that aren't not yours but are somebody else's, like a family member's. Those people are governed by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and they are allowed to contact you for one reason and one reason only, and that is what's called skip tracing or location information. In other words, they can't even tell you that a family member owes a debt or that they're trying to collect a debt. All they can do is contact you and try to get location information. Do you know the location of so-and-so? And if you tell them no, that pretty much ought to end the inquiry. If they go further, if they repeatedly call you, and especially if they mention that they are trying to collect a debt, they have violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. Now, what you can try to do is to record that phone call and get their contact information, at very minimum, the name of the debt collection agency and their address and their phone number and whatever information that you can obtain from them, and take that to a consumer protection attorney, because that violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. That allows the consumer protection attorney to sue them for statutory damages and for attorney's fees that you don't have to pay, that the bad guy, the wrongdoer, has to pay. So my advice is to not take this lying down, but to instead, if it's a debt collection agency, take it to a consumer protection attorney. Is this helpful to you?
Yes, it is. Thank you very much.
Okay, you're most welcome. Thanks for being on the show. You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law offices of McGuire Woods in downtown Richmond, and we are speaking with attorney Nathan Kottkamp about national health care decisions today. Welcome to the show, Nathan.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Great to have you on the show. Now, National Health Care Decisions Day is this Saturday, April the 16th, just 3 days away. Tell us, what is National Healthcare Decisions Day?
National Healthcare Decisions Day is a nationwide event that is designed to encourage all Americans to have information and resources to discuss and document their advanced care planning wishes, and then put those into an actual document, advanced directive, and share them broadly. And then, of course, on the flip side, to be sure that providers are doing a better job of eliciting those wishes and honoring them whenever people become patients in facilities.
Now, I gather that this grew out of something called the Virginia Advanced Directives Day. Could you give us a brief description of the history of all of this?
Sure. In 2006, we started Virginia Advanced Directives Day here. We had an amazing amount of participation in Virginia. Specifically, we had 100% of the hospitals across the state participated on that day, and we had a smattering of nursing homes and hospices and other organizations as well. And we repeated that feat in 2007, and with that as a great model, and Virginia as the example, we took it nationwide in 2008.
Tell us, what is an advanced directive? I understand there are sort of two different types. Could you explain that to us?
An advanced directive is any sort of document that sets forth in writing what it is a patient or a person would want in the event they become a patient and are unable to speak for themselves. And you asked about two types. The first is the designation of an agent, someone to stand in your shoes and speak on your behalf if you're unable to speak for yourself. And the other is traditionally known as a living will, and it's a document that provides written instructions about healthcare choices, typically end-of-life choices, but in Virginia, it can address mental health choices and any healthcare choices at all. It doesn't just have to be end-of-life decisions.
Okay, so let's talk about those one at a time. Let's talk first, I guess, about the durable power of attorney for healthcare, I guess sometimes called a medical power of attorney. Who is allowed to sign such a document, and what are the mechanics for doing so?
Well, actually, the requirements for signing either type are identical. All it takes is the person who is writing the document to sign it, specify his or her wishes, and get two adult witnesses. No notary is required in Virginia, and you don't need to use an attorney to do it.
And those two adult witnesses, can they be anybody, including blood relatives, spouses, or do they have to be non-blood relative, non-spouses?
They can be any adults. There was a rule change, so you may still see, you know, things never die in the internet, so you may find old forms in Virginia that said that a spouse or blood relative could not be a witness, but that rule has changed. And it can be any person at all. It can even be the person you designate as your agent, although I don't recommend that in most cases.
Okay, now the durable power of attorney for healthcare, when does it take effect?
It only takes effect when a person has been determined by two physicians to be incapable of making informed decisions. So just because you're admitted to a hospital, just because you have a certain diagnosis, whether it's dementia or Alzheimer's, does not mean that you lose your decision-making capacity. You actually have to be determined as such by your physicians.
And once determined so by your physician, how long does that determination last?
It is supposed to be renewed every 180 days.
Once that determination is made, what does the person named in the medical power of attorney, we'll call that person the agent, how does that person, the agent, make those health care decisions for the person who is, quote, incapable of making an informed decision?
Well, that agent stands in the shoes of the patient. So just as a physician would be talking with the patient, seeking informed consent, discussing treatment options and care planning, they would be doing that with the agent instead. So you are literally acting in the capacity of the patient, speaking for the patient.
So I gather it's important for the patient who signed a medical power of attorney to have some discussion with the agent at some point about what his or her wishes would be.
It's critically important. You know, we see a lot of situations, and I see this on the ethics committees that I sit on, where someone will name an agent. They won't even let the agent know that they've been named. And so we get a document, we get a patient who has some sort of adverse event, and they are now incapable of making informed decisions on their own, and we call up the person who's named as the agent, and this is the first that they've heard about it. So it's great to name your agent, but it's a disaster if you haven't had a conversation with that agent.
So I gather that once this medical power of attorney is executed, it's critically important to get a copy to the agent. Who else should have copies of that medical power of attorney?
Well, certainly you should give a copy to your primary care physician. Many hospitals will allow you to send in a copy, and they will keep it in a registry within the hospital. So if you have a hospital of choice, then it's already there. These are obviously documents that maybe you aren't thinking about in the event of an emergency. So best to have those ahead of time. And also family and friends. If you have a close neighbor, loved ones, it's best for these documents to be shared broadly.
And can this medical power of attorney be changed once it's executed?
Absolutely. They can be revoked at any time. If you do need to make substantive changes, though, you need to get it re-executed with two more witnesses to be sure that it meets the legal requirements.
Now let's talk about the living will, the other type. What is a living will?
A living will are a set of written instructions that a patient may give with respect primarily to end-of-life choices, but it can be for any sorts of choices, whether it's the use of antibiotics, blood transfusions, mental health treatment. But it sets forth in writing, for example, patients oftentimes have very strong wishes with respect to the use of a ventilator or artificial nutrition and hydration. And they can set those wishes in writing, and they are required to be followed by both the agent and the healthcare provider.
Now, when does a living will take effect?
Same as the agent. It takes effect when a person has become incapable of making informed decisions. When that determination has not yet been made, we communicate with the patient themselves. And if they have not named an agent, then we go directly and solely on that living will document. And if there is a living will and a declaration of an agent or that durable power of attorney, then that living will serves as a guide for the agent in making decisions.
Now, I gather that this is a change from what the law used to be, because my understanding was that a living will only took effect when a patient had a, quote, terminal condition. I gather that's no longer the case.
That's right. That's no longer the rule. In Virginia, living wills or these written advance directives now apply regardless of whether a person is in a terminal condition, and they can apply more broadly than just end-of-life decision-making issues.
So if you had a do not resuscitate order or something of that nature, that essentially is part of the living will?
Effectively, a DNR order, a do not resuscitate order, also sometimes known as allow natural death orders, are actually orders written by a physician. Now, what they should do is track a patient's wishes in a living will, but those are orders that need to be written by a physician that individuals can't write those themselves, and an advance directive does not necessarily equate to a DNR. And in fact, many people use their advance directive to say that they would want to be resuscitated and they would want other measures. So these documents can be used for the full array of health care or no health care at all.
So basically, if you can imagine the type of treatment that you would want or the type of treatment you would not want in a situation, you can put that into a living will.
Yes, you certainly can. The other thing that people do and that those of us in the field often encourage is to describe, not necessarily like a checklist of if I have certain condition, I want the following treatments or things done to me, but also to talk about things like what motivates you, what are your passions, what makes life meaningful, what are your religious backgrounds, because it's very difficult for us to anticipate all of the medical things that might happen to us, particularly as lay people. But if you provide some of these parameters and some of these things that are more values-based, that can help the agent when they're trying to deal with medical conditions as they're evolving.
So it sounds like these advanced directives are something that every adult should have, regardless of age, regardless of physical health, because you just never know what might happen.
That's absolutely right, and particularly young people need them. We oftentimes think of advanced directives as something that only apply to elderly people or those that have a serious medical condition, but the best examples that I like to give are the fact that the major cases that made the law and made the news in the United States with respect to advanced directives were all women in their 20s. And if men are out there wondering, well, how does this affect me, then the example I like to give is Lance Armstrong. He got his cancer in his 20s. So we just never know. It could be a car accident. It could be a stroke. It could be dementia. We just never know.
So National Healthcare Decisions Day is 3 days away. If someone who's listening is interested in getting an advance directive, and we hope they are, what should they do?
Well, first visit our website. It's www.nhdd.org or nationalhealthcaredecisionsday.org. Either address will get you there. We have a number of resources, including Virginia-specific resources, if you click on the public resources link. And there are also a number of decision-making tools. There are some that are extraordinarily detailed, some that are very, very simple and elegant. And sometimes it's just those elegant questions just to get the ball rolling with your family that you need. And we oftentimes find that all you need is that little catalyst to get started, and once you do it, the conversation oftentimes just flows very naturally.
Okay, and is there anything else that folks need to know about how to get an advanced directive done, either this Saturday or at any time?
Well, I think the most important thing is just mark your calendar and do it. It's not an easy thing to talk about. It's not an easy thing to think about. And it's one of the reasons so few Americans have actually done it. Only about 25% of the population has an advance directive. So take the inspiration of National Healthcare Decisions Day. Stop making excuses and just do it.
Thank you so much. We have been speaking with Nathan Kottkamp, and he is an attorney at the law firm of McGuire Woods here in downtown Richmond, talking about National Healthcare Decisions Day, which is this Saturday, April the 16th. Thank you so much for being on the show, Nathan.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 9.1, which deals with Commonwealth public safety. Since 2004, bail enforcement agents, commonly known as bounty hunters, must be licensed by the Department of Criminal Justice Services. Under this law, Code of Virginia 9.1-186.9 not only requires that if a bounty hunter carries a firearm in the course of his duty, he first must complete basic firearms training and receive ongoing firearms training, but also, if he discharges a firearm during the course of his duties, he must report it to the department within 24 business hours. To keep Commonwealth from turning into the Wild West, bounty hunters must pull out a pen every time they pull the trigger. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. A new federal rule, which will take effect May 1st, strengthens protections for bank accounts with directly deposited federal benefits. Join us next week when Virginia Poverty Law Center's Executive Director, Jay Spear, describes how creditors no longer will be able to freeze and take funds from bank accounts that contain Social Security, SSI, VA, and other federal benefits. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.